Here. It's a great pleasure. It's the first time for me to talk at such a nice place. So I will talk about a work which I recently did with my PhD advisor, Dominic Schwarz, from Bielefeld. And this is about mainly about something we put on the archive 3 weeks ago. So, yes, that's my overview. So first, I would like briefly to mention the main idea of stochastic inflation, what people did there, and mention what are possible problems and where possible, and what one should possibly extend. Then I will focus on two methods which I used, which I basically learned during my diploma time when I discussed condensed matter systems. One is a replica trick, and one is a Gaussian variational method, which both of which I never saw applied to stochastic inflation. And then, of course, we come back to stochastic inflation, discuss it in the light of this replica field theory, and we'll discuss results. So, okay, in stochastic inflation, what's one doing? What one want to describe? One want to describe the dynamics of some quantum field in curved space-time, and want to make an effective description such that. Okay, first I'll explain. And first, I better say something different. To be concrete, I focus on some minimally coupled real scalar field with some mass mu in de Sitter space-time. So I choose this kind of metric, and this, of course, is a test field where I put the metric in by hand. This is kind of first approximation or kind of toy model which you may choose. Of course, everything in GR it exists. Everything you should, a better formulation should take into account of the back reaction from the field to the geometry. But this I put now in by hand. So the main idea is that you split the field into a part, say in a Fourier sense, and one part which contains the long wavelengths and one part which contains the short wavelength. So something like if you have an expansion like this, you insert some kind of filter function which selects, if you have this short wavelength, which selects the short modes. A prime example is what Sarabinsky also did, who invented this thing. You choose kind of step function. But you, in more general cases, may have some kind of smooth filter function which cuts out the high frequencies. So. And then what Sarabinsky said, well, let us think of phi L, so the long wavelength field, as a kind of classical field which evolves in an environment or in a bath provided by the quantum modes, or the short wavelength modes, phi L. So this gives rise to kind of stochastic differential equation. So if you just take the free field equation, so box plus mu squared phi equals zero, which where the phi is a full phi, and if you make the split, then you end up with such an equation where this is an equation entirely for phi L, but which has, instead of zero on the right-hand side, a kind of Gaussian distributed random variable. So it can think of it kind of Gaussian random force, which is in turn correlated to some kind of random potential. So of course in okay, I'll mention it later. Well, and it was recently shown by Richard Woodard and collaborators that if you do this, I guess Woodard considered phi-force theory and scalar electrodynamics, that this captures the leading log contribution to, say, the energy density and the pressure. So you generally have some, if you compute the energy density and the pressure, you have some kind of sums of powers of this logarithms of the scale factor, and if you just take the leading terms, it's what you get if you apply this formalism. So far, so fine. But, well, usually, if you say, I discuss a potential, like so you have some V prime of phi here, and then you, inside this phi, you make a split of phi equals to phi L plus phi S, then you should have on the right hand side higher order terms. You should have some powers of phi L with coefficients sourced by this, where is it? Of the short wavelength modes. So you should have kind of random potential. But people usually consider just this field equation. Also, they put a kind of classical potential on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, you just put this variable, this random variable. So we thought, well, one can improve, and one actually can. And this, when you use both methods I had mentioned in the beginning. So as I said, I learned those methods in my diploma when I discussed condensed matter systems. So, and it's kind of easier to discuss it in this context. So let's think of a very simple example, two-dimensional finite lattice. And suppose your temperature is zero, and you impose a boundary condition that in the upper edge all spins. Say you have, on each lattice side, you have a variable which can take assign two values, and say spin up, spin down, you take a temperature zero. You say, well, all spins on the upper edge are plus, and all spins on the lower edge are down. Then you have a domain wall which is completely flat. But in light, nothing's really pure, nothing's really perfect. You have kind of impurities, some vacancies or some wrong or missing spins or missing atoms, if you wish, which cause this kind of domain wall, which forms to be rough. So, okay, you. And then you might think of more dimensional system or continuous system where you have, in general, some kind of rough surface. So, and the thing is now that if you compute then some observable, don't know what, for example, free energy, you have to deal with always with averages. So you have to average the kind of the random impurities out. You have to average over different samples of that. And this can be, in general, pretty hard. For example, if you want to average the free energy, this is, of course, the logarithm of the partition function. So you have to average a logarithm of a partition function of a path integral of some of an exponential of some random variables. So this might be difficult. So, well, and there's one trick, which is actually pretty old. I think Giorgio Parisi dated back to at least the 14th century, when I guess there was a bishop of Lisieux who tries to define non-integer powers of real numbers. But of course, he didn't know, this bishop didn't know about the free energy, but well, who knows what's in the secret archive of Vatican. Well, and the thing is that you can actually express such an average of the free energy as this thing. Now, the main point is that the average here goes inside of the logarithm. So you have just to average z to the n. So z to the n are n non-interacting systems or n replicated systems. That's where the name replica trick comes from. So, and of course, if you average it, the thing, you introduce some kind of interaction between those replicated systems. And at the end, of course, it's a bit tricky because, I mean, here I send n equal to zero, and this only makes sense if you have n integer, so it's a kind of tricky thing. If you do that and hope that everything's analytic in n, and then you make a limit n going to zero at the end. But sometimes it doesn't work, so but often it worked and it shows a lot of power. So, okay, when I talk about disorder and about random variables, I have to drop some words on distributions. So let us assume that we have a Gaussian distribution of mean zero. So if we average this disorder potential, the random potential, just zero, and if you take two, you have some kind of non-trivial stuff. So you think of it just as Taylor expanded, and every coefficient is a random variable, and then you average over. So, and you say you have some correlation in position space or in space time, if you wish, and some correlation in the field space, where I put two indices here because of the different systems where when these are replica indices, and so I have to say what to do when you average two potentials with indices coming from different replica systems. So of course, if you are in the picture where you have point-like impurities, you have this just contact terms basically. Then you have this function will be a kind of delta function. So the last trick before I come to stochastic inflation So the application of those things is based on this fundamental inequality, which is called Feynman-Jensen inequality. It's very simple to prove. And the thing is that the real free energy is always a lower bound. It's really an exact inequality. So it's, you can prove that this is always a lower bound to the right-hand side. Now, what's the right-hand side? The right-hand side is evaluated. So every quantity which carries a zero is evaluated with respect to some Gaussian Hamiltonian. So we plug in a Gaussian Hamiltonian, and you evaluate the right-hand side, and this is always larger than the free energy. Of course, then what we are now doing is that we take this Gaussian Hamiltonian, or Gaussian action, if you wish, and minimize the right-hand side, so find the best Gaussian theory which approximates our real system. Of course, if you start with the Gaussian system, there's no loss of information. And one has to take care, because this is now a matrix also in the replica space, this the matrix G, right? So it's a bit more complicated than one might think. So and then one makes a kind of ansatz. One says, well, on the main diagonal in this replica space, I have the thing without any noise terms. I have the kind of thing which I get when I solve the field equation equal to zero, so without any noise terms, and this is the full propagator. And when we use this kind of replica structures as a variation of parameters. So if you do that, you find basically some equation. The concrete form is not so important, but I just want to stress that it's kind of implicit equation, because here you have this function r, or the derivative of r, which occurred in the second cumulant here. So there's r. It's the derivative. And inside you have the inverse of that propagator. So this is defined as the inverse. And so you have sigma in a complicated way on this side and on this side. So it can be pretty hard to solve. So if you then apply this thing to stochastic inflation, where you also have this stochastic forces on the field equation, or more general, some random potential, then you, the one observable you want to compute is, of course, the power spectrum, and turn the spectral index given by this relation. So this power spectrum is linked to the two-point function, so this G, and this is precisely the G what I have here. So I can just apply the methods. And what I find is quite interesting. I find that I have one part, which I just get by solving, the noiseless thing. So I drop all those quantum modes, if you wish, drop the tree-level thing. And I get, as I expect in four dimensions, the scale invariant spectrum. So just put the mass equal to zero, you find just the spectral index is one. If spectral index is one, so P goes to k to the n minus one, so it doesn't scale. So it's scale invariant. So if one part. So the other part, this is new. This is really of quantum nature, if you wish. It has stochastic origin. And this guy dominates at large distances. And this will produce some large deviation from scale invariance. So you see, I mean, even if you put mass equal to zero, you'll find that the scale invariance is heavily violated. You have spectral index minus three. So, but this you will only find on very large scales. And okay, so then you might ask, well, okay, what the formula I presented to you, I mean, does it make any sense? I mean, does it, or in other words, when is this guy coming important? So then, okay, so this you can do. You can just say I put this term here equal to that term, and this gives me some scale, which in general depends on time, which tells me far above which those terms become important. So, and if you do so, you find the following plot. So I have to explain. So here on this axis, I plot the co-moving k star in units of the Hubble constant. And on this axis, as time, also with h suitably rescaled. So, and the solution is really the thick dashed line. To concentrate on the thick dashed lines, there's a result for different masses. So above, the uppermost line, which goes here, also is for mass equals zero. And the larger you put the mass, the steeper the curve gets. Okay? So, and you should read it like the following. You have far above those lines, for large k, which means small distances, you find the ordinary scaling, so this is the noiseless propagator, so this G0, so the scale invariant spectrum. But for very small k, which decays exponentially, I mean, it's a straight line, so, and this is a logarithmic plot, so it decays exponentially. And this is co-moving, so it, in physical units, it's even more. You have to divide by the scale factor to get the physical scale. So it is pushed to larger and larger scales. Okay, so so far below scale invariance is violated. So at very large distances, what I calculate is that scale invariance will be heavily violated. So of course, you can play the same game for power law inflation. So the different lines mean here that I choose different p. So power law, the scale factor just a is equal to something like time to some power p. And this is for different p. So it's p equal to 10, 12, 14, 16, 18. You see kind of same behavior that the later it is, the further those scale invariance violating terms go away. So, okay, that brings me to my conclusion. Okay, I showed you an outcome of the application of replica field theory to stochastic inflation. I showed you a manifestation of what people call cosmological dimensional reduction. That's one can unjustify the name, but just keep in mind that I showed you that at large distances, we have a lot of deviation from scale invariance, at least what I calculated. And this is also a measure for non-Gaussianity, because what one basically finds is that this, let's get back, that this sigma here is basically proportional to FNL square. It's very nice. I have, for the sigma, I have an analytic formula, so I can tell you how this FNL, which comes out of this formalism, behaves as a function of time and as of momentum. And so we have a measure for this FNL, and I calculated the time behavior of the scale, which tells you when are the new effects, the stochastic terms, become important. So now I'm currently working on, of course, other geometries, dependency on the filter function. Let's see if things really independent to have some meaningful results. And of course, this was done for the free case, but you might discuss arbitrary potentials, and this goes to the vast field, which is known to in statistical field theory for a very long time, replica symmetry breaking. And of course, an open problem is to take into account the back reaction of the field onto the geometry. So that's also what comes out. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, speaker. Questions?
Yes. I mean, the two-point function is, in any case, that, I mean, is let's see, where it is. So this guy, so if you just solve, you take the free field equation, say box phi equals zero. So this free field equation, oops, sorry. Then you find that this guy goes like one over, at large distance, one over k cube, okay? So this produces the power spectrum, because you multiply by, four dimension, multiply by k to three, it produces a power spectrum which doesn't run. So so the two-point function diverges, so g of k diverges in any case if k goes to zero. So, but this is, has an even stronger k dependence. So this goes like, I think, something like 1 over k to 7. So it means you can put more correlation or more structure on large scales. I guess maybe you read this. This is, was an article by Linda and Metz-Lumian, I guess, where they have all those very hilly kind of landscape on very large scales, kind of very vast structure. So this is maybe some manifestation of that.
Cool. Let's thank Florian again. And it's time for